The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and we are in our new studios, and hopefully you can hear us well and the audio's fine. If you do have feedback for us on audio or any other issues, I'd love to get it from you, so please don't be shy. And one other quick announcement about today. We're going to be on the 60-minute format. This is mainly due to my having gotten a cold and bronchitis, and I'm still coughing like mad, so I'm not sure I'm going to be able to hang around for 90 minutes. So we're on the 60-minute format, so please watch your time carefully. If you want to get a hold of our guest today and fire off a question or a comment or talk with him, please pay attention to the time. So a couple of very quick announcements. The toll-free line has not changed. It is still the same for you. And it is 1-866-687-7223. And remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. And then you can also communicate with us by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or our blog, which is part of our website. And if you need instructions on how to do the blog, please email me, and I'll send them back to you by email. And a couple of other quick website announcements. Our detailed website newsletter gets published later today after this show, and you'll see who's on board for all of this coming week. And many of our shows may be on the 60-minute format, depending on when I'm able to quit coughing. But we have a full schedule, except for Friday. Friday, our engineers are back here, and we're doing some more line and tweaking of the computer, so there will not be a show on Friday. But everything we do is archived, and you'll see the coming events in the website newsletter on our homepage. Don't forget we have a store in the upper left-hand menu under support, and also listen live is an important part of that upper left menu, and that tells you how to listen to Space Show programs live, archived off of our website, on our different podcasting services, and on Alexa with the TuneIn player, which is embedded. And you can use that right off of our website if you're using Alexa. And as I said, we are a listener-supported program, and your support is what keeps us on the air with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, your gifts are tax deductible on the federal side. The same is true for those of you who are in California or who pay California taxes. And again, without your support, we would not be able to bring you these programs. So we thank you for your support and your participation in the program. And we also do business sponsorships, and the business sponsor gets their message going across our website in a banner ad, which they can change pretty much as often as they want. You'll see five of them going across our website right now. And they get a 60-second or less promo message read by me on each regular length program. On the shorter programs like today, I simply thank and mention our sponsors as part of each program. So we have just a couple of these sponsorships left. And if you're interested, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And the sponsors for today that I want to thank, And again, we're on the 60-minute format, so I just want to thank and appreciate them, and that is the Integrated Space Plan, the Space Foundation with their 34th symposium coming up around the corner, Orbital ATK, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and Celestis. So if you have any questions or want to reach any of our sponsors or you have any comments about their banner ads, please let me hear from you. So I'm very happy to bring back to the program today George Sowers. Dr. Sowers has 30 years of experience in space transportation, working for Martin Marietta, Lockheed Martin, and ULA. He recently retired from his position as Vice President and Chief Scientist at ULA, where his team developed an architecture for fully reusable in-space stages fueled by propellant mined, refined, and distributed in space. Dr. Sowers has joined the faculty of the Colorado School of Mines as part of a newly created graduate program in space resources. He has a BS in physics from Georgia Tech, a PhD in physics from the University of Colorado. Dr. Sowers is a fellow at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. George, welcome to the Space Show. How are you, and how are you enjoying retirement?
Oh, I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much for having me. And actually, I think I'm flunking retirement. I'm as busy as I've ever been supporting this new graduate program at the Colorado School of Mines.
Well, that's a good place to start out. This is the only graduate program or maybe academic program totally focused on space resources. So tell us a little bit about this program, because it's really unique.
Yeah, you're right. We announced this program at the end of the summer of last year, and as the first ever graduate program in space resources. It's kind of a appropriate thing for the Colorado School of Mines to do, because Mines is world-renowned for its expertise in finding, developing, and exploiting terrestrial resources. And so a marriage between aerospace and Colorado Mines' expertise, you know, makes a natural place to go do space resources. We have gone through the program approval process that had been approved all the way up through the state of Colorado Board of Education, and the program formally starts in the fall. The applications process will start in a few weeks here. But in the meantime, we've been teaching. Last fall semester, we taught the first course and graduate course in the fundamentals of space resources. And this semester, we're teaching the fundamentals course again, and then I'm also teaching a space system engineering class that has an emphasis in system engineering as applied to developing systems to extract and develop space resources.
Do those of you in the program, can you find material, textbooks, information for your classes, or do you basically put it together and make it up as you go?
It's a little bit of both. The literature in space resources is vast. People have been studying space resources from, resources on the moon to mining asteroids and, even further afield than that. People have been studying that for decades. And so there's a very large literature out there. There have been a number of books written on space resources. We pull from all of those. In my system engineering class, I'm basically using a textbook that's a standard system engineering, graduate level textbook, but then all of the examples and assignments are directly taken from potential space resource projects.
What do you expect for enrollment, and what's the typical background of someone who would be interested in pursuing this field?
So, as you can imagine, space resources is a very multidisciplinary field. Expertise from, geology, planetary geology, mining engineering, economics, any other type of engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, chemical engineering, You know, essentially any STEM field and economics or economics would be a good background coming into this. You know, a successful space resources project is going to be pulling from, you know, dozens of different technical disciplines to be successful.
Do the students get a PhD or is this a master's program?
So we're offering a certificate, a postgraduate certificate, which is basically 12 credit hours of the core courses. We're also offering a master's as well as a PhD. The certificate and the master's can be done online. The PhD, you know, because of the the extensive research involved has to be done locally at the School of Mines here in Golden, Colorado.
Any idea what kind of enrollment you'll have?
So when we announced the program and established, you know, this sort of pilot class in space resource fundamentals, it's filled up within days. We limited it. It was an online course taught synchronously using, you know, online video capabilities. We reached capacity within a few days. And then for the spring semester, we upped the capacity of the class and actually ended up being oversubscribed and having to, you know, get a waiver from the school to include more students. So far, we've had no lack of interest. And the interest is worldwide. In the space resource fundamentals class that we're teaching this spring, we have students from three different continents, from Europe, from Asia, North America, obviously. We have students from a lot of different states all across the country, and they're people that are, you know, either full-time students or are working in the space industry or want to work in the space industry. So we've had just a tremendous amount of interest from all over the place.
You have your first email from a listener. Jack is in Tucson, and he says, do you think your program might be premature? We don't seem to have the fully developed legal and policy infrastructure in place for space resources, nor is all the technology and the hardware available, nor is the financing around. So maybe it's a decade or maybe longer out in the future. Is this the time to be offering a degree, or is it too early?
So we thought a lot about that. We don't think it's too early. We think that our graduates can help build all of the types of infrastructure, whether it's legal, regulatory, technological, or, you know, the actual infrastructure in space. So we think it's actually the right time to be building interest and building, you know, the expertise. The academic side of developing a brand new field, you know, has to go hand in hand with developing the field itself. And, you know, we didn't want to wait until, you know, everybody's doing things. We want to educate people that will be part of creating this new industry.
Do you have any connections to or association with the policymakers, like the National Space Council or anything like that that's going on in this new administration?
Yeah, we have been in discussions with some of those kind of folks. For example, back in September, I was part of a panel testifying before the U.S. House of Representatives Space Subcommittee of the Science Committee, and they were interested in commercial exploration of the moon. There's a lot of companies that are interested in developing, you know, private landers to the moon, like Moon Express was on the panel with me, Astrobotics was on the panel, NASA was on the panel, Blue Origin was on the panel, and so I think, the promise of resources, I think, can shape a lot of what's happening in the U.S. space policy sector. One success, I think, and it's hard to know, you know, exactly what caused what, but President Trump's directive just prior to Christmas for NASA to go back to the moon included the purchase back to the moon for more exploration and utilization. And it's that utilization part, which I think is different from previous NASA space programs, and it's absolutely key to having a sustainable program.
Given your long association with ULA and what they've done in propulsion, are you personally, or is the program launch agnostic as to how we get to and develop space resources? For example, do you go against SLS, for example, because it's so expensive and, you know, all the things that people like to complain about? Or do you want to see private companies, or does it not matter to you? It's not really part of your curriculum.
Yeah, the curriculum itself is agnostic to it. You know, my personal beliefs, you know, I'm a strong supporter of private sector activities in space, and would love to see those expand and succeed. And the reason is really simple. I want the space enterprise to grow. And the way for things to grow economically is through the action of the free market, and that means private companies competing, you know, best idea wins, competition drives innovation, lowers costs, it's good for everybody. And, you know, the utilization of space resources, again, is a way to kind of bootstrap that whole thing. You know, space has been, I won't say stagnant, but the growth of space, the space industry has been limited by the high cost of launching everything from the gravity well of Earth. And as soon as we can develop capabilities to utilize resources that are already out of the gravity well, then, you know, the economic activities can explode.
Do you see the policy? I mean, we talk a lot on the space show about the policy, the legal issues, the Outer Space Treaty, what many other countries want, which doesn't seem to be the same as what many of the space entrepreneurs want on this side of the big pond. I'm sure you probably have some legal or policy classes in your program, but how do you see sort of these tug-and-war confrontational points being worked out over the years as this industry starts to develop, or do you see them working out?
Oh, I eventually things are going to work out. You know, and we're connected with the policy community. You know, in the space resources fundamental class I was talking about, you know, we devote, you know, a couple of lectures to space policy and invite, you know, experts from the field of space law and space policy in to, you know, talk to the class. You know, so we're trying to just teach awareness of what the issues are at this point. You know, my opinion is that, you know, frameworks will have to be established. I don't see that legal issues are a significant impediment to where we need to go in the next five-ish years. We had the Commercial Space Launch Act of 2015 that, you know, gave some top cover to folks that want to go develop space resources. It basically says you have property rights insofar as you can see what you extract. You can't claim celestial bodies, but if you extract the water from the poles of the moon, you're entitled to keep it and sell it as you wish. So I think we have enough to get started. As things go further, you know, a rigorous property rights regime, you know, kind of akin to how you do a mining claim in the, you know, the Sierra Nevada mountains of California or in the Rockies of Colorado. You know, those kinds of rules will need to be established, but we don't need to do it yet. And I'm kind of the, you know, of the bent that says, you know, don't put regulations in place to solve problems that don't exist yet. Let's figure out what the problems are we're going to solve before we start regulating stuff. So that says be patient and, you know,
keep working and as problems arise from some as they come up.
Listeners, just to note, we do have some audio issues on the phone line. George, I assume you're on some sort of a digital or cell line, right?
I'm on a cell phone, yes.
Yeah, and you're in the mountains?
I'm in the foothills, but I have really good reception.
Because we're breaking apart a little bit, so it sounds like it's a digital or a cell phone. I have a question from you. And listeners, I'm going to take the phone call. I was just about to complain again that you guys aren't making phone calls. So let's see if I can find the new controls on the board. Welcome, caller, to the Space Show. Who are you, and thank you for calling, and where are you?
This is Marshall, out here in Nowhere, Oklahoma.
Yes, that is a good description, okay?
And I have the same cold, so excuse my coughing, too. Anyway, one of the things I've read about these different moon bases and so on like that, I have never seen a good list of the minimum amount of electricity requirement, the minimum amount of water and, you know, module space and so on like that to establish any of the bases. Generally, they talk in big fuzzy terms. Is that part of the course, is coming in there and doing the, what is a minimum design for the first lunar base?
It's not specifically part of the course, but, you know, it's definitely a factor in systems engineering. So in systems engineering, you know, one of the objectives is to figure out all that kind of stuff that you need. And it's been done in, you know, for a lot of different specific projects. I don't think there's a general answer to your question. How much power do you need? It kind of depends on what you want to do. You know, I'll give you an example. We just did some research at the School of Mines late last year on what would it take to establish the first water mining operation near the poles of the moon. And we absolutely calculated, you know, how much power we're going to need to generate enough water and then electrolyze that water into the hydrogen and oxygen propellant. And so we did detailed calculations on exactly how much power we were going to need and figured out a number of different potential solutions to providing that power. So I think those questions have been answered, but to answer them precisely, you need to have a specific idea of, you know, how many people are you supporting? What are those people doing? Are they trying to operate telescopes? Or, you know, how are they getting up and down from the moon? All those other sorts of details have to be defined and worked out before you can say, I need, you know, 3 megawatts of power or whatever the number happens to be.
Well, it also boils down to the basic logistics of what can you make locally to, word is, I think it's in-situ resources,
yes,
that you can use, and there's a big hole there that nobody really knows about.
Yeah, no, that's true, and that, you know, those in-situ resources are exactly what our new program is focused on. You know, one of the products on the moon that will be valuable as soon as, I think, is water in the poles of the moon. We know now that in the poorly shadowed regions near the poles of the moon, there's icy, you know, the regolith, the dirt down there is icy, up to maybe 5 to 10% ice by weight. And that ice can be melted, turned into water for drinking water, and then it can be split into hydrogen and oxygen, which happen to be the two most, you know, the most efficient chemical propellants known. So one of the things we've been saying is that the poles of the moon, you know, water is the oil of space. You have large quantities of water at the poles of the moon. Therefore, we should start thinking about the poles of the moon as the next Persian Gulf.
And the Persian Gulf eventually is going to be pretty much solar-powered also. Interesting.
I guess. I wonder if they'll form a cartel with the moon and other planets or destinations out there, like OPEC. You call it space pack or something.
You know, one of the great findings of space science in the last 15 ish years, is that there's water pretty much everywhere in the inner solar system. We know there's abundant water on Mars. We know there's water at the poles of the moon. And many asteroids are, contain large quantities of water as well. So where you have water, you have hydrogen and oxygen, and where you have those, you have rocket propellant. So, being from, you can think of, the next generation space resource guys will be like the Wildcatters in Oklahoma.
Good one. I'll let someone else talk now.
Thank you very much, Marshall.
Bye.
And listeners, the toll-free line is available, 1-866-687-7223. So before Marshall called, I was going to read Kathy's email, and she's in Seattle. And she said, many of us were surprised, yes, some of us really were surprised, that the Google Lunar XPRIZE program was canceled with no real contenders making an effort to get to the moon, at least making an effort to have a scheduled launch on the books. Do you think that this is a setback for space resource development?
I think it's a minor setback, and, I'm not that familiar with the Lunar XPRIZE guys and why they decided, they could have extended it again. I think there's a number of companies that are really close. I think Moon Express is the closest. And, they've been waiting for their launch vehicle to get certified. They've signed a deal with the Rocket Labs people out of New Zealand a few years ago, I think it was. And, they could have launched before the end of the year if their rocket had been ready. I think you may recall that the first Rocket Labs launch had an anomaly, and then that delayed the second launch, which I think was supposed to have been Moon Express. That got delayed to do another essentially test launch so they could have a proven rocket before they go. But I think Moon Express is really close. I think Astrobotics is another company that's very close, and I know they've signed a deal with my former company, United Launch Alliance, to launch them to the moon. I think it's notionally 2019. So I think there's a number of companies that are close. And, I know there's some international folks that are pretty close to iSpace guys out of Japan, and there's a team in India. I don't think any of those people are stopping just because the Lunar XPRIZE has been canceled.
So a minor blip along the way is your perspective.
Yeah, I think it's a minor blip. The money would have been helpful to one of these companies, but only one of them was going to get it. It was good money, but it's not a deal breaker for any of them, I don't think.
Well, it wasn't enough to compensate them for what they've invested in their companies.
No, not by any means.
Not by any means, yeah, absolutely. Do you think that there is a role in space resource development for public-private partnerships, given that this is evolving as a commercial venture? So normally government doesn't do a lot of things that are commercial because they don't make a profit, at least not the way public, private companies do. So does government involvement sort of maybe hinder resource utilization, or what's the proper role of government?
Well, so that's a big open-ended question. It's one I've thought a lot about. I think, the short answer to your first question is I think public-private partnerships in developing space resources could be hugely beneficial, especially since NASA is being directed to go to the moon first and go there for utilization. Utilization means you're going to use the moon and use the resources on the moon to help sustain our presence on the moon. And like I said before, one of the first economically viable resources from the moon will be water for propellant, water for consumption, water for oxygen, all in support of that moon base. And one little fact I'll throw out here is if you had farm available from the moon at a price that I actually established when I was back at ULA, then the cost to go from the Earth to the moon will be reduced by more than a factor of three. I think that would have huge benefits to NASA's return to the moon program, to cut the transportation costs to a third. And therefore, if NASA stood up and declared that they would be a customer for propellant mine on the moon or an asteroid for that matter, doesn't matter where it comes from, then that would be hugely beneficial to any private company having a large anchor tenant, if you will, that's NASA. The same thing goes for ESA when they want to establish a moon village. ESA would be, you know, or any sort of European Space Agency type of thing would be a great customer to have if you were a private company developing refining propellants on the moon. So, and, you know, if private partnership is that the government entity ends up being a customer of the private sector entity, and that's a great model to have. And that's a little bit like what we're doing now with the commercial cargo and commercial crew, where NASA is buying services that NASA needs from the private sector.
You have another email. Excuse me, from Dr. Doug in Southern California. Lunar, polar, water, and organics could be used for propellant, drinking, sanitation, irrigation, oxygen, plant food, organic materials such as plastics. Hey, why not throw in stroke recovery? Doug, we can put them in a chamber on the moon with oxygen. So do you know if anyone has calculated the percent launch mass reduction that would be achieved once those volatiles were being harvested and processed?
So the short answer is anything that you can get on the moon, you don't have to launch from Earth. And the cost of launching things from Earth to the moon is pretty high right now. When I was at ULA, we published a number of, I think it was $35,000 a kilogram to launch mass from Earth to Moon. The percent reduction, I don't know for all those other commodities, but certainly in propellant, the cost would be dramatic. Like I said before, the cost to go to the moon if you use lunar propellant, that $35,000 a kilogram number drops down to, I think it's $11,000 a kilogram, something like that. So it's a significant reduction. But anything you can get off the moon is mass. You don't have to launch from Earth, and that's money that you save. I think the percent reduction would depend on exactly what it is you're doing and how much of the resources you can use. I will say there's not a lot of evidence that there's a lot of carbon-type molecules on the moon. The one farm data point we have came from the LCROSS mission, where we crashed. It was launched by ULA. We'll plug them again. And the upper stage of the Atlas rocket, the Centaur, was guided into the Cabeas crater near the south pole of the moon. And then the debris plume that was ejected was measured by a little payload that came off. And we learned that that's all we learned, that there could be 5 to 10% water ice. There were indications of small amounts of methane and a few other sort of sulfide type components. The paper on LCROSS, I think, listed maybe a dozen different volatiles that were measured. The large majority of the volatiles were actually water. Which is good. There's small amounts of other things, and those other things, when you're processing the regolith, the coals, would either be contaminants that you want to get rid of, or you save them to use for other things as, opportunity arises.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
How you doing, Dr. Space? This is Floyd in Tacoma.
Okay.
And I was wondering from Mr. Sowers, the only plan I've ever really dug into and seen and thought was, in my mind, a good plan for in-situ resource utilization and also just going to the moon in general has been Dr. Spudis' plan. Do you find that plan to be viable, and are there any other plans comparatively do you feel are strong candidates for getting this ball rolling, per se? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I count Paul Spudis to be a good friend of mine, and I am an admirer of his work. And a lot of the stuff that we're doing at the School of Mind is in very similar directions. I mentioned the research that we just completed at late last fall was, you know, developing actual engineering concepts as well as the economic model that goes with them for mining that water on the poles of the moon. The other parts of his architecture that I think are compelling and that you know, we actually developed real solutions for while at ULA is the idea of the transportation system built off of LOX and hydrogen, liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen propulsion, with fully reusable stages that can cycle back and forth between the surface of the moon and high Earth orbits and then high Earth orbits down to low Earth orbits. And the architecture for that in-space transportation system has actually been published by ULA, and based on their design for the advanced cryogenic evolved stage called ACES. So, yeah, I think Spudis' architecture is great. I'm a big proponent of free market solutions, so I'd love to see different companies competing for different elements of that architecture. And, you know, I'm sure the free market would develop all kinds of innovative solutions that go well beyond what Paul's put out there.
He took his answer on the air, so he's not with us anymore. I'm going to ask you this question. You know, it's kind of maybe sensitive, so if you don't want to answer it, feel free to take a pass on it. Jim is in Boston, and he says, Dr. Sowers, I hope you don't mind a rather sensitive question, but in the wake of the demise and bankruptcy of X-Corp, I am aware that X-Corp was involved in some form of engine development program with ULA. Did ULA lose anything? Was the bankruptcy a big blow to ULA? Was it a program that was really valuable that got canceled? Can you say anything at all about the bankruptcy of X-Corp and how that might have impacted ULA? I believe you were probably still at ULA when this happened.
No, it happened shortly after I left. I was always a fan of X-Corp. Their early days when they were, founded by Jeff Grayson, who remains a good friend of mine. And, they had some very interesting technology that I sponsored personally from my position as VP of Advanced Programs and Chief Scientist. It was, what we were really interested in was their concept for a piston-driven liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen engine. And that was one of the candidate engines for this ACES upper stage I just was talking about. I think, as time went on, X-Corp obviously was not in the best financial shape. And, they just didn't have the capacity to develop their technology as rapidly as ULA needed. Unfortunately, they had to be dropped from consideration. They just were not far enough along. I think there's still promise in the technology. And I'd love to see, some other company, through the bankruptcy process pick up that IP somehow. I don't know how that would work. I'm certainly not familiar with any of the legal issues associated with the bankruptcy of the program. But I think they do have some intellectual property that would be valuable to somebody. and still think the idea of a piston-driven liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen engine has a lot of appeal. And it has the promise to maybe be a much lower cost, high performance engine than the ones that are currently available.
You have another caller on hold. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Mr. Sowers, I wanted to know how much the ability to study in-space mining is limited by the number of unknowns. There's a lot of things you just can't put into your calculations because you just don't know what the figures are. What sort of projects are your students able to do, and where do they have to sort of stop?
Yeah, so you've hit upon, that's a great point that you just made, what we know about, there's much more that we don't know about space resources than what we know. And if you think of, developing a mining operation or, developing a, petroleum reserves or something on Earth, what you do is you prospect, or you do exploration, using all sorts of different scientific techniques. If you're looking for, oil and gas off the coast of Mexico, you're using, seismic type, geophysical measurements and things of that nature. One of the things that we're teaching students is what kind of prospecting methods you would use in space. How to do remote sensing. Just by looking at the outside of an asteroid, you can essentially tell what at least within certain bounds, what it's made of. But eventually what we're going to have to do is create the space equivalent of the mining guy with the pick and the mule. Maybe small, and companies are working on this, Planetary Resources and Deep Space Industries are working to develop small prospecting type spacecraft that would be low cost and that could go out and do host surveys or even take samples. The project we just worked at on the poles of the moon, one of the big unknowns is we don't really know what the ice is like. We have one data point from crashing a stage in there. The area where the ice is are what are called permanently shadowed regions. The sun never penetrates there. And so it's hard to look in there. We've got some radar measurements that give us some indications. But before you do any mining on the moon, it has to be preceded by a prospecting campaign, where you're gaining the information that you need to be able to design mining equipment to extract the resource.
Do your students get into the kind of project where they would design a complete architecture to send a mission, something like that, or is it more specialized?
No, actually, that's exactly how we're approaching the program. We have 5 core courses as part of the curriculum that you have to take, and then there's a whole slew of different electives that you could do. But one of the core courses is a design project where you would actually, design from beginning to end, an architecture or some hardware that would be part of a space resource type program.
Great. I did want to ask about the ACES upper stage and stages like that. If you're taking as a given that they're operating completely in space and they'd be refueled in space, then what becomes the limiting factor for how long a stage like that can last and how many times it can launch?
Well, once you refuel it in space, we really don't know. I mean, that's an excellent question. The environments that a stage like that would experience in space are far less severe than the environments getting in and out of Earth's gravity well. Those environments are incredibly severe and they are incredibly life-limiting. Once in space, I'm guessing that, certainly it's going to be something to do with the engine, and life limits on the engine.
replacement of the engines if there's more than one. There may be soft goods that need to be replaced. There may be lubricants that need to be replaced, things like that. And so I can imagine in the future that there are, you know, maintenance stations in space, you know, kind of like, you know, your automobile service station on Earth, where you go in and you get an oil change and you get some, you know, some belts replaced and a few things like that. But, you know, the basic hard goods of the stage should be usable indefinitely.
Hmm. Okay, thank you. Those were great answers.
Thank you for the call, Kim.
Thank you.
Listeners, there's still time if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. And Linda is in Phoenix, Arizona. And Linda says, what is the state of art of development of robotics and AI to allow prospecting like you're talking about? I assume there actually won't be some old guy with a beard and a mule in spacesuits walking around on the surface of the moon or someplace, but maybe the robots will be designed to look like that. What is our technology like for developing the robots and the artificial intelligence to do that? Are we close to being technically ready, or do we have a ways to go?
So there's clearly room to make significant advances. I chaired a panel at SpaceCon, a conference that was at in Houston in December, and had, you know, four space mining experts, you know, one from NASA, one from Deep Space Industries, one from Planetary Resources, and one from Off-World Industries. And I asked the question, what's the greatest technological challenge from where we are right now to being able to successfully develop space resources? And all four of them were unanimous that it's that autonomous operation, you know, machine learning, artificial intelligence, all that kind of stuff. You know, I kind of view it as, you know, the current state of the art is pretty good, and it all is based on, you know, what we've done from a space science standpoint. You know, think about the Curiosity rover that's been on Mars for, you know, close to 10 years now, you know, and the Spirit and Opportunity, I mean, one of which, I can't remember which one, is still operating, you know, after, say, 15 years. You know, those are... they have enough smarts on them to execute a pre-uploaded plan. So, you know, the scientists on the ground figure out what they want the rover to do, and then they upload the thing, and then it does it. There's a 20 or so minute delay, so you can't teleoperate. So, you know, we've actually got a lot of smarts in how to do robotics in space. You know, there's a, you know, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft from NASA is on its way to do a sample return from the Bennu asteroid. That'll happen. It'll actually do its approach to Bennu later this year. So, you know, we've done a lot of pretty cool things robotically that are probably, that technology is probably good enough to do the kind of prospecting that we need. I think we need advances in making it lower cost. You know, I think things are going to need to ratchet up a notch when we actually start doing mining. But the mining industry today uses a lot of robotics. You know, in deep mines, it's certainly a lot safer and more humane than sending people down there, to send machines down there. They do teleoperating. One of the great benefits of the moon is that it's close enough that you can teleoperate. And the mining design that we came up with at Mines last fall, we assumed that all of our machines that, you know, the machines that we needed would be teleoperated from people sitting in a cubicle somewhere on Earth, which certainly, you know, reduces the technological demands of artificial intelligence and that sort of stuff. But as soon as you start mining asteroids, they're going to be too far away to do that, and you're really going to have, you know, probably an extra notch up in machine learning and robotics. That's going to be a big part of any future space resources operation.
Dr. Doug sent you an additional question, and let me read it to you To what extent do you think that ice-harvesting telerobots could be developed in terrestrial labs with simultaneous vacuum cryogenic temperatures, abrasive dirt, three-second time delay, and suspending five-sixths of the weight with tethers? Would doing these things create a realistic analog environment?
That's the biggest challenge of doing anything in space, whether it's space resources or anything else, is being able to test your equipment in relevant environments. And everything he just said in that question is absolutely true. If you want a real relevant environment in, you know, to simulate the permanently shadowed regions of the moon, you know, it has to be deep cryogenic temperatures, you know, on the order of 40 degrees Kelvin. You know, it has to be 1/6 G. It has to be, you know, dark. It has to be hard vacuum. You know, all of those things. There's the dust environment. You know, all of those things have to be considered. I don't think it's feasible right now. It's probably feasible. It's probably not affordable to have all of those things accounted for in a single test. But I think you could probably do a good job of testing, you know, each dimension of the environment potentially separately, which is kind of what we do now for spacecraft that have to operate, you know, in space or go out to the outer planets or things like that. You know, the individual components are tested in relevant environments. You do a whole bunch of analysis to try and account for things that you can't test, and then, you know, you keep your fingers crossed when you actually go up there. But, you know, to me, learning how to do all that is going to be aided by just starting to do all that. We need to get rovers down into some of these currently shadowed regions. We need to start, you know, digging and extracting and getting some experience.
On the job training.
Yes.
Adrian in San Diego sent in an email with a chart, which I can't really do much with, but it's a chart of L-Cross and LRO definitively prove existence of volatiles at the lunar pole. It's apparently a NASA chart. To answer Dr. Doug's question, the L-Cross impact site regolith volatiles were 15% of the ejected, only about 49% of the total was organic carbon-based material. As a comparison, the concentration of H2S, or rotten egg gas, which is highly poisonous, was almost 1%. Adrian, if you want to post this on the blog for today's show, that would be really cool. And down at the bottom of the chart, it says volatiles comprise possibly 15% or more of L-Cross impact site regolith. So I don't know if you have a comment on any of this or not. You've probably seen the chart that he sent.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar. I can't picture that particular chart, but I certainly read the paper that the L-Cross team published in the journal Science that described the, you know, the findings. And it's all hopeful, you know, the fact, you know, we know we have one pretty definitive data point that says there's, you know, a decent amount of water. And to quote Paul Skoutis again, you know, Paul estimates that there could be as much as 10 billion metric tons per pole. And that kind of takes me back to that Persian Gulf comment again, that, you know, if there's really that much ice up there, that's a hugely important resource right on our doorstep and most of the way out of Earth's gravity well.
Do you see, well, first of all, what does near-term mean to you? When someone says a timeline is near-term, is that like within a five-year period from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could see, you know, the beginnings of mining operations at the poles of the moon in the 5 to 10 year time frame, especially if, you know, we can draft a little bit on the coattails of a NASA program that's going back to the moon to stay. I think that's entirely feasible. Based on the work that we've done, there's really no miracles have to occur. The technologies that, you know, that it takes to get water out of regolith is basically just heat. You know, the ice in these permanently shadowed regions is super cold, and to get it out, you just heat it up. You know, all of the other details about, you know, how to operate in a hard vacuum and the super cold and the 1/6 G and all those other kind of things, you know, we have experience on all of that and other applications. And to me, it's just the system engineering problem, how we put it all together and then how do we make it affordable and close the business case. I think that's probably the bigger challenge, is being able to do it at a cost that makes the resource, you know, affordable to sell within the cislunar space.
Randy is probably the last email of the day since we're on the 60-minute version. And Randy says, do you see this resource extraction becoming a big bonanza for people here on Earth? Are we talking about bringing resources back to Earth, or simply finding ways to use them in space, creating markets and business opportunities in space rather than trying to transport everything back to Earth? How do you see it?
I think that the use of these resources certainly initially will be in space. You know, there's obviously no need to haul water from space back to Earth. Now, there's plenty of water here. You know, people have talked about, you know, some asteroids having large quantities of platinum group metals and things like that. But again, I think when you really look at the economics, hauling mass back to Earth is not something that's going to be in one of the initial uses of space resources. I will say, however, that to me, one of the most exciting uses of space resources is to construct large, very large solar power plants in space and beam power back to Earth. The materials for these large solar power plants would be sourced in space, so they would be manufactured by space resources. But in the longer term, you know, there's space solar power could potentially be an inexhaustible, completely green source of energy for Earth for a billion years or more. You know, and that's pretty exciting. That basically says, you know, frees Earth from any kind of energy constraints, which is something that we all worry about these days. You know, whether you're, you know, how concerned you are about climate, you know, certainly energy resources on Earth are constrained. Energy resources in space are essentially unconstrained.
This is probably going to be the last question. Connie is in Houston, Texas, and she says, we hear constantly that going to the moon is a stepping stone for how we're going to do things for going to Mars. The moon is our learning ground. Are the things that you're talking about today, the lunar prospecting, resource utilization on the moon, maybe some other destination closer to Earth, is all of this really a stepping stone to Mars? Is it going to be similar to what's on Mars, or would Mars be radically different, and this is really not a stepping stone?
There are many things that we learn on the moon that will be extremely valuable to helping us do things on Mars. Mars is obviously different. You know, it's got higher gravity. It's got a little bit of an atmosphere. You know, it's got lower sunlight. You know, there's certainly differences. But learning how to do things in these harsh environments is going to be extremely helpful. A lot of the technologies will be directly applicable. But to me, the greatest benefit of the moon is the resources of the moon, which enable us to get to Mars. I'll just give you one example, and I keep coming back to propellant. Propellant mined on the moon can lower the cost of a Mars mission by a factor of 4. And that's imagine a factor of 4. So to me, going to the moon first and developing lunar resources is the only way to make Mars missions affordable in anything like you know, the near enough term to be within my lifetime or many of our lifetimes.
So from your perspective, it's definitely a needed stepping stone.
Yes, absolutely.
Has there been something we've omitted or that you wanted to be sure to tell us about with the Minds program or something else, given that we're at the 60-minute point in the show? Have we forgotten something?
No, I just point you, if you want to learn more about the graduate program or potentially take classes or enroll, you can go to the Colorado School of Mines, just Google Colorado School of Mines, hit that top page, and then search, do a search on space resources, and that will direct you to our webpage that describes more about the program.
Can anyone enroll in the program or take the program, or do you have to be accepted to your graduate school? What's the credentialed part of applying? What's that about?
Yeah, so if you want to be in the master's program, you have to be accepted as a graduate student. For the certificate, the requirements are actually, you know, less. You basically have to have an undergraduate degree in a technical field or economics. You know, if you think you're qualified, you know, without that kind of a degree, and maybe have work experience or something, you just contact us. And the certificate program is pretty much open to anybody that has an undergraduate degree. And then once you're in the certificate program, if you do well in the certificate program, you can get into the master's program on that basis.
You did get one more email that squeaked in just on the time thing. Adrian said, David, you misread the organics, excuse me, at 49% value. It was 0.49% or less than 5%. Also, the water content was 5.5% and carbon monoxide was 5.7%. So again, if you post it on the blog, Adrian, people will see where I flubbed it and get the correct information. So maybe one of these days I'll tell you all the story of why I misread things and my problem with my vision that has cropped up, but not for today. That's another one. George, I want to thank you for being with us and for letting us know about these new activities that you're involved in mining and what you're doing. And it looks like a great program. I mean, it'd be fun to just sit in the classes and kind of like audit the classes. I don't know. Can you do that?
Yeah, not right now. We haven't figured out how to do that. You can certainly register and take a class. But anyway, I thank you, David. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, and I look forward to talking to you again down the road. Listeners, that's it for today. We have a full week of programming. Check it out on the newsletters. And everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Thanks to George and all of you for calling and email. Goodbye from the Space Show.